webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for June the 5th, 2014, coming to you from the GR Studios right here in Nashville, Tennessee, where with Maya Angelou, we say, listen to yourself, and in that quietude, you might hear the voice of God. And from Houston, Texas, here is the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Mr. Michael Williams. G'day, Mike.
Good evening, Bears Bartlett.
How are you, friend?
It's been a really good week. My goodness. I, of course, returned from the birth of my grandson, Corbin Dean Williams Snoddy, S-N-O-D-D-Y.
There you go, Mike. That's all the gospel revolutionaries out there cheering you on, Grandpa. It's wonderful news. Absolutely wonderful. Congratulations, mate. And also to Mother and Father.
We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing. Everyone can sing.
I've got a story or two for us this week, and I know you've got something on your heart you want to share. Michael, this week I read on Alternet an article by Laura Gottensteiner, I think. I hope I'm doing it right by you, Laura. And do you remember years ago, or not that long ago, there was a thing doing the rounds on the internet, and it said, these are the most religious states in the US, and they were all painted red. And then it said, and these are the states that have the most tornadoes, and they were all painted red, and they were the same states. Do you remember that thing that was going around? Well, this is like it. The story is, religious states are also the unhappiest. How, how, you might ask, do they know this? It's very easy. They know it because they did a study on the states where most antidepressants were sold. And guess what?
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, it's the same states, mate, as the red states in the tornado picture. Now, maybe it's because we all have tornadoes down here. Maybe that's why we're depressed.
That's maybe the reason everybody's depressed. I definitely might be one of my conclusions that I would bring out of that. Goodness, of course, with the tornado state, there's some things that you do a statistical analysis, and you know, you can draw anything out of them that you want.
You can. Mike, did you know that you can drown in a river that only averages 3 inches deep?
Yes, you sure can. So, but the fact that these states, most religious states, are the ones that get all the tornadoes, you know, there could be a connection there in that the tornadoes drove the people to being religious. That I could see, and there really is a train of thought that people who, and I would have to say people who don't understand the gospel, would become more religious after a tragedy. than they were before or in the middle of a tragedy. But the issue of the antidepressants, goodness gracious, I have no comment.
Well, maybe I have a comment about this. You won't believe what the number one state is.
I would say that since you have such a look of glee on your face, it's most likely Texas.
No. You and I don't live in either. It's Utah, home.
Oh, really?
Of Salt Lake City. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And should we?
Oh, it's such a beautiful state.
Should we use the M word here?
Oh, well, we've done worse, I suppose.
Yep, there's lots of Methodists in that state. Not counting more.
That is what Utah is known for, is their Methodist, you know.
I've got a lot of method, I'm telling you that. So I was just blown away because the top 10 most religious states, 9 have higher than average use of antidepressants. How's that prayer thing working out for your family?
Goodness gracious.
Oh dear. Oh, okay. Now listen, I got a text from our great friend Danny Rogers. He was a proud recipient of one of our pharosectomy certificates a couple of pledge drives back. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Hello, Beres. Hope all is going well with you and Laura. By the way, I have been absolutely overwhelmed by the love and just the tidal wave of real expression and real sincerity that I've received from GRs and for Laura and myself. And thank you, guys." He says, "I have a question. Was the teaching of grace a prophecy in the Bible? Is it something..." Now, just as an aside, you and I have a habit of saying that God said that I will do nothing unless I first show it to my servants or prophets. Mm-hmm. So he says, "Was this teaching of grace a prophecy in the Bible? Is it something that the whole world will recognize? I know Mike's goal is to reach 1 billion people with the grace message, but maybe all will know. Could that happen? I believe it could."
Well, first, thank you, Danny, for that great question. We appreciate it, and we always appreciate when people when you text us, email us, do anything. It always makes the show much better. We also want to congratulate you on your pharosectomy. Beres was so very diligent to get these things done and out. I hope that is a tool that you can use to provoke conversation about the gospel. I know this was, Beres's idea, and it was for that purpose, to provoke conversation about the gospel, have something hanging on your wall. And the issue of the gospel and was it prophesied? Grace was prophesied. In fact, every time that the expression of any judgment or anger or wrath was foretold by the prophets, right behind it was this incredible, merciful grace and peace that were to replace this. You cannot separate grace from peace. I'm beginning to notice that people that come to understand grace without knowing the gospel of peace, there's something super spiritual or superficially spiritual about the understanding of grace.
How do you define grace?
Well, grace, number one, is the absence of law. More than anything, it is a relationship with God that has nothing to do with performance. Grace is something that God did in his establishment of a new covenant for the entire human race. This is not something he did for us as we respond or our interaction with God. And that seems to be what it becomes when the gospel of peace is absent from the equation. The gospel of peace means you do not get what you would have deserved under the law. And grace means you do get what you would never deserve under the law. This is really playing out around the world. Now, the issue of grace is coming to the forefront. And, man, I'm telling you, it really is. It's a flood. There is a flood. So The thing that I would say also is that now that we have the time and space to do this, which is way beyond my lifetime and way beyond anyone's lifetime who is now living and breathing, and way beyond their lifetime and beyond, since we've got the time, yes, I'm very encouraged. If we were in the end times and we had only a certain amount of time to do this, yes, I'd be very concerned. But communication is on our side. Reality, critical thinking is on our side. There's so many things that are on our side. It's just really amazing. I was watching an interview with Seth MacFarlane the other day. He is the creator of Family Guy. Seth MacFarlane is an avowed atheist. And he told his story how that it during the greatest break that he had in his professional career came in September of 2011. And he was in the Northeast and had scheduled a flight out of Boston on flight 11 to come back home to Los Angeles. He was running late and got to the airport and walked up to the ticket counter or to the boarding lounge and walked up to the lady. And he said, "This is my flight." And he said, "I need to get on it." She said, "I am sorry, sir," says, "they just closed the door and you can't get on the flight." Well, of course, flight 11 was one of the hijacked flights during 9/11, that everyone on board that flight was killed. Now, this is not an almost or anything. This man, he had paid for his flight. He had his boarding pass, and the door was closed the moment before he went in. The interesting thing is that that did not make a believer in God out of him. You might say, "Well, Mike, you know, if it had been me, I would have certainly been rejoicing and praising God that he kept me off that flight." But see, then you have thousands and thousands of people who were on the flight and the families of the people on those flights as to why God didn't do the same for them. Why didn't he delay them in traffic? So all of this confused mess about superficial, everyday parking space spirituality, I think, is one of the things that we are going to be having to buckle down on in the gospel revolution, because there's a lot of grace understanding spread in the world, and it seems to be wanting to put the icing on the cake of Christianity. And grace is not the icing on the cake of Christianity. It just isn't.
Now, if grace is a free gift, and it is a giftedness, a niceness that God gives us, what's an example of that in the Old Testament? Danny says, was this prophesied in the Bible?
Well, again, I go back to the gospel of peace, because you cannot understand grace unless you understand the gospel of peace. And that is the absolute declaration of peace out of the book of Isaiah, where he describes the cross and compares it to the floods of Noah, where that the first world was destroyed by flood, and then begins to speak about the cross and says that as a result of the flood, God put a bow in the sky and said, "I'll never do this again." And that as a result of the cross, God said, "I will never be angry with you again." So this consideration, number one, that God is not angry, this measurement of life based on how favored are you by God, as opposed to how favored somebody else is. You see, if Seth MacFarlane had become a believer in God based on the fact that he missed flight 11, he would have become a superficially spiritual, some brand of religion that would have made him exclusive to the rest of the world.
Oh, would have made him a rich man too. Can you imagine the testimonial circuit, eh?
Oh my gosh, yes, I can totally imagine that. It was totally wrapped up in all of that. I don't claim to have all the answers, but the one thing I'll never be gullible to again is parking space spirituality. I'm not going there again. And this powerful grace that was foretold by the prophets, the peace of God, that God would never be angry with us again, the prophecies of his favor upon us. One of the prophecies is about laying this new cornerstone of the new covenant, and he's had the prophets to stand by back and cry, "Grace, grace unto it." So, yes, there's a tremendous amount about grace and peace both, because please remember, grace and peace go hand in hand. If you have no reason for the cross to have taken place to remove an existing state of almost what you would consider to be war between God and man, then you are not going to be able to grasp this grace that was established for every human being for a specific purpose of uniting God and man together as one. We are going to make it a personal experience, and suddenly everything is up for grabs as to who God is favoring. Oh, God, you know, I got a good job, God's favor's on me. Oh, well, I got fired, so God's favor's going to be somewhere down the road. Or I'm under a curse from the devil, or I did something wrong and I've walked out from under the umbrella of protection. We have been there. I've been there. Barris, you have been there. I'm not going there again. When grace and peace become these parsed out experiences of individuals based on their own beliefs and their own circumstances, the gospel of grace is gone. It just isn't there. It's just a religion. Just because you use the term grace and parking and grace and missing the plane and mercy and missing the flight that crashed, just because you use the terms does not mean that there is any definition of the gospel of grace and peace in those things that we have spiritualized instead of accepting the quality and profound work of the cross, in which God had determined that he and man were going to become one entity.
So what happened was the gospel of peace. How it happened was an act of grace. It was a gift. Is that?
That was the gift of God to us. Absolutely. God declared peace with the entire human race at the cross. Why? Why did he do it? What does that look like? What is the result of that? And if he isn't angry, we need to understand why he's not angry. Because the human race isn't a whole lot different than it was when Jesus died on the cross. There's many things that we could point to, but there's still mostly the same things are here that were there at the same time. The cancellation of law, the eradication of Adam's transgression from off the face of the earth.
Now the first one. The cancellation of law, this really affected the Jewish people. But the second one, the eradication of sin through Adam, that affected the whole world, that is of major interest to the non-Jewish portion of the world.
Yes, and we could teach that just that precisely, Barris, if the Christian world had not applied God's law to the entire population of the world.
How selective, though? I know, because having been a pastor, I know that I never once asked all the men in the congregation to drop their pants because I wanted to check out if they were circumcised. It's incredibly selective.
Oh, my.
Totally selective.
Yeah, and Jeff is doing a great little series right now on his weekly videos of about God's crazy law, which I thought was that's a good way to put it. You have to kind of say these things. Now, Jeff says some provoking things, which, you know, he's given me a call and said, "Hey, did I go too far?" And of course, those around me usually know that I'm probably going to say, "Well, you didn't go far enough." We say whatever we have to say to try to break through the numbness of mind.
Great way of putting it.
I'm getting ready to go to Calgary, and I'm going to be teaching on the mystery of the gospel. And I think it's extremely timely right now because, like I say, there is a grace explosion on the earth. The gospel is something that is a settled issue. It's not things that are being decided every day by God. God made his decision. God fulfilled his plan. God did the deed. God established the covenant. And it wasn't one where that he has worked it out where he and man can get along now. And if he confesses his sins, and if man lines up, and if man goes to church or goes to synagogue or goes to temple or whatever, this is not something that God did waiting for us to do our part so that he can be what he wants to be in our lives. The entire message of the gospel and its impact in our life comes solely from acknowledging the truth.
Well, let's come back to Danny's question. He says, I know Mike's goal is to reach a billion people with the grace message, but maybe all will know. Could that happen?
Oh, yes, it could. Now, here's the interesting thing. The text that all will know him from the least to the greatest is quoted by Paul, I think in Romans, but it's quoted from the scriptures. When you look at the term know, that all would know him, it means to have a mental assent. It means a knowledge of. It doesn't mean anything more than that. And I thought, well, you know, how do we, at what point, how would that be a fulfillment of scripture? Because here's the thing. I teach that the fulfillment of scripture all took place at the cross. So if this was a prophecy that was given before the cross, that all would know him from the least to the greatest, this is really screwy. I mean, this is now based on current knowledge and someone's personal experience with this.
Yeah.
It would not be a prophecy that was fulfilled at the cross. And I just don't believe there's such a thing as a prophecy that was not fulfilled at the cross.
So how do you account for that difference, Mike?
Well, when I went back and looked up the verse that from the scriptures, it says, they shall all know him from the least to the greatest. I was blown away because the term know there has to do with being kin, blood related. And it's like, my gosh, yes, this was fulfilled at the cross. And all shall be blood related. All shall be kin.
Is that using
a blood relation with God himself at the cross?
Is that using the yada root, the Hebrew root yada, which means?
I don't remember.
Yada is an interesting, I'll have a look while you're talking, but yada is an interesting root because the best way of explaining yada is to say the verse that people love to quote, be still and know that I am God, and also the verse when David is dying, he's giving all of his advice to his son Solomon, and he says, Solomon, above everything else, know your God. That word is yada. But that is the same word that's used when Adam knew his wife and she conceived and bore a son. This is a word that means intimately related.
It means more than just knowledge. It means a relationship.
Yeah.
And they will all be in relationship with me. So, and all are in relationship with God. I got very excited. Now, in many cases, let me encourage people that when you read a prophecy quoted in the New Testament, please always go back and look it up in the Old Testament and see what the Hebrew rendering of that is. Because many times the translation into the New Testament loses meaning. It can lose a drastic amount of meaning. And in this case, it lost so much meaning that it took it from an all-inclusive experience for the human race to an individual experience for each person. And that is a drastic loss of understanding of a prophecy. So once again, the scriptures were fulfilled, were completely fulfilled at the cross, even this one, and they shall all know me from the least to the greatest.
Mm. You know, it's not the people who agree with us, it's the people who question us that help us make progress. That's how we've done it since day one. What are your thoughts on what we've just been talking about? Why don't you call me on area code 234-564-0971 and let us know what you think about that. Else you can just email us at freedom@gospelrevolution.com. That was freedom@gospelrevolution.com. What do you think about that?
Gospel Revolution.
Hello, everyone. My name is Billy. I'm from Kitco, Florida. And I just want to say hi and that I love the Gospel Revolution. And I just wanted to talk about a couple things. The Gospel Revolution is all about love and acceptance and being the observer. Mike has a post, a podcast on that the most powerful position and the only position we have is that of the observer. And something I notice about what facilitates us in being the observer is being present in an attitude of non-judgment, where if I enter into the commentary in my mind that wants to comment and set forth its opinion on whatever it is I'm looking at, I lose that place of the observer. The observer doesn't comment as such the way our minds are used to commenting on what it is we're looking at. So if you want to be more of the present of the observer of your life, refrain from judgment and, well, opinion. What I think about a situation is not the observer. The observer doesn't comment in that sense of, I think this is whatever. So I just want to encourage everyone to be mindful of the present moment. It's the only moment you have. Thanks.
If you need a lift in your spirit and want to have a great day, listen to the Gospel Revolution.
Gospel Revolution. What do you think of that lead-in that I used by Maya Angelou? Now, I'm going to get you to explain to our audience who Maya Angelou is, because last week she died. She's in her 80s and she dies. And there's a flurry of activity across the web of Maya Angelou. And I said, yeah, who's this? Because as a non-American, I had no idea of the worth, value, and importance that Maya Angelou provided to the whole American experience. So tell us who Maya Angelou is, and the quote that that I wanted your opinions on was, this was her last tweet before she died. Mm-hmm. And she says, "Listen to yourself, and in that quietude, you might hear the voice of God." That is some wisdom. So I want to know, who is this chick?
Exactly. And she's loaded with this stuff. You know, she has been really dispensing this stuff from her heart for many, many years. Maya was an actress, a singer, and in the progression of her life became a poet. And for many purposes in the first part of it, was a poet for the civil rights movement.
Jeff tells me she was an American poet laureate.
Yes.
Wow.
And very highly acclaimed in actually in many fields, but as her age progressed, this just poems of wisdom, little facts of wisdom were certainly her calling card. I think Oprah Winfrey considered her to be a mother to her, as many, many, many people did. And just this very stable force with this very calm demeanor and always with something very encouraging and enlightening to say, just like this comment that she has made. Now, just as it got your attention, Barris, it gets my attention. There are people who have never heard, per se, the gospel. at least taught by me or you or anyone else. And because they have systematically eliminated much of the superficial spirituality, they've been able to find this great contact with that which is already there. You see, you and God are one, whether you know it, believe it, like it, lump it, this was God's decision. You are his dwelling place. And Maya's statement here to, in that quiet time, listen to your own voice, because you just might hear the voice of God. That's how close this is. And I'm really, really do appreciate you bringing it up, because it was one of the things that I thought, goodness, this is such a great point. And yet we have people who are avowed to and greatly studied in many circuits of religion and many facets of Christianity who can hear this but never make the connection. How could you possibly hear the voice of God through your voice? Oh, my. Because they're one.
you're reminding me of something, and you're going to tell me whether I can let this go to air or not. Do you remember the movie The Jerk?
Yes.
With Steve
Martin.
Steve Martin. So just for those of you who haven't heard that movie, and please, you have to. This is a must-see movie, in my opinion. So the movie opens, and he's with his family, and his family love certain kinds of music, and he just can't get with that music at all. He listens to his transistor radio under the covers in his bed, and he tunes into other music, and he's really off on this other music, can't get enough of it. And the only problem is he doesn't realize that he's not like the rest of his family. He doesn't realize he's adopted. The family are a black family. He's a white boy.
Yes.
And they're all out there on the porch clapping, doing the offbeat thing, and listening to this great music. And he's trying to clap on the offbeat, can't do it to save his life.
It's a hilarious movie.
Doesn't understand, why am I different? I'm so different, and this is my family. He doesn't even know that he's not black. He
just, yes.
But he's listening to that which was deep inside him.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was an adopted son, this wasn't kind of inside him as like it
yes.
was the rest of the family. That's a picture. I'm sorry, mate. I'm just. But that's a picture I was getting as you were saying. They hear what's deep inside them.
Hear from inside, exactly. And this is the profound and wonderful thing about the races. Even the expression of God comes out of us differently. Even by the difference in our races. This is the only thing, Barris, that's going to break down these racial barriers and all of this bigotry that's going on, is when we are able to see God in the face of every human being and realize that the expression of God in that individual or in that group of people is going to be different than what it is in me personally. Or the group that I go to. I'm part Cherokee Indian. I have Cherokee.
I've never felt secure around you, and that probably explains it.
Well, you don't have enough hair anyway, so.
You got a lot of sharp knives and axes there in your house. That's all I know.
I have Cherokee from three different lines from three generations back. And I'm very proud of that heritage. It is something that I really, really enjoy. And I know that the expression of God through even the Cherokee people, I mean, they never heard the gospel, but they definitely had a very profound spiritual identity and a value. And what that did is create a value in them for each other and for the earth and for the air and the sky and the water. And this is the thing that they prized in their expression of God living within them.
Well, they more than most people that we're in our modern age currently aware of, they believed that all was one.
They did that.
Now I've had Christian friends who denigrate this and they call it animism, where you're worshiping the spirit of a tree and that. But at the lowest common denominator, they were actually believing that they were one with everything.
Exactly. With any of their writings, this was always brought out, was this issue that it was of utmost importance to the Cherokee to understand that they were one. And even more than a gospel sense, they believed they were one with everything. And it worked for them until the Europeans came in and began to believe that their opinion had to be imposed somehow over that. A lot of times when people are talking about one race against the other race and all of this, I wonder sometime, and I know there's a lot of mixed race people, which I am a mixed race person, and I listen, and oh my goodness, the more I learn of the history of what happened in the colonies and the Cherokees that were here, not just the Cherokees, but thousands of Native tribes, which I think most people know now that the term Indian was imposed upon the Native, what we would call now a Native American, was imposed because the people who first discovered this thought they'd found India. And so the people that they found here, they called Indians. And it just, I was thinking about that, and it's like, my goodness, here we have this imposed name that has stuck. Now, you talk about an identity that can be formed out of absolutely something that is untrue. You don't have to look very far than to say the word Indian, and the first thing you see is feathers and somebody on a horse, especially since it was the Spaniards who introduced the horse to the Indians. They never rode horses.
not a bad name, Indians, for people who migrated across the land bridge from Mongolia. I mean, when we Anglos make mistakes, I mean, we do them on a cosmic level, mate.
So we have this. So for me, it's like, and I listen to this history. I listen to the history of what happened on both sides. And it's like, okay, so which part of me do I get mad at? You know? Because I am a descendant of those who oppressed, and I'm a descendant of the oppressed. I'm interested in the expression, of course, of God in the Cherokee tribe because I am a descendant. We have a challenge before us, Barris, and that is to understand grace not in the expression of whether or not I get a space to park in or God is answering my prayers or not, but the real challenge is to see God in everyone and every group and every race that is on the face of planet Earth, and to accept that there is going to be a different expression of that based on personality and based on the cultural group that you come out of.
So what I'm hearing you say is there is what in mathematics is called the lowest common denominator, which probably would be we're all human. That's the one thing. Then you go up a layer on that and you have we are all one. Mm-hmm. Then you go up a layer on that and you have Fijians and Australians and Native Americans and French and German. So you have all of these, and then you've got the color. There's black, there's brown, there's yellow, there's red, there's all manner of colors. So all of these are overlays, I'm hearing you say, on the lowest common denominators that we are all humans joined at the hip. We are all one.
Yes. It's a very good way of putting it. The interesting thing, and this came up in our discussion a few power casts back, but, many times when we express criticism toward Christianity, and anyone who thinks Christianity does not deserve criticism, I just think you just have to be outside the thinking population. You cannot put Christianity in a category that says that this has always been a good thing for this planet, because it just hasn't been. It's just all there is to it. My goodness, the Christians killing the Catholics and the Catholics killing the Christians, and them and then exporting all of that and going around the world and killing everybody who didn't believe. You just can't say that this is not worthy of criticism. And then to draw the line here, Barris, well, Christianity has done some really good things. So that's what I'm supposed to use as validation that Christian doctrine is correct, is that they do some good things? I think that that comes out because of that lower common denominator. We're all human. You see, you can even be good, a good person, and still be a Christian. Whoa. Now that's the power of God. You can be a Buddhist and still do good things, because our basicness of who we are is that we are human and that we are one. Now, just because I get involved in a particular religion and they organize something to where that, the hungry can be fed or something, doesn't mean that that religion deserves the kudos for the deeds done. Because if we're going to give kudos to Christianity for its deeds done, the positive deeds done, I'm sorry, I really hate to say this, but then you're going to have to give kudos to the Taliban also.
You hate to say that, do you?
I really hate to say it.
Yeah.
But the fact of it is, in the lives of people in other parts of the world, the Taliban provides food and provides medical attention, clothing, help and aid in many, many, many different ways. You say, yeah, but as Christians, you know, we're not going around killing everybody. Well, not right now, we're not. But you see, you cannot divorce the history of Christianity from the current expression of another religion who is killing people around the world and say, because of that, there is nothing similar about these two religions. Just because it was 500 years ago that we did it in mass. Now, it's certainly, goodness gracious, if you include the degradation and molestation of children, why is it that we want to validate these religions and yet take no responsibility for the things that also happen that are profoundly horrible within their ranks, such as the molestation of children? Why does that seem to be higher there than any other place? So we just, the whole thing stinks. The whole issue of trying to validate righteousness by performance, to try to validate relationship with God based on good deeds even. That can't be our validation. There has to be something that is going to appeal to this world, because just like Seth MacFarlane went to get on that plane, and when he stepped up to that gate and the agent said, I'm sorry, the gate is closed, and he was able to walk away from there and still remain an avowed atheist, I'm telling you, I was excited. Now, I would much rather Seth understand the gospel, but I am so glad he did not buy into the experience-based mentality of Christianity and all of the other religions. Now, you got to understand, when we make criticism of Christianity, it's because it's where we came from. So don't get on to me because I'm criticizing Christianity and not this, that, or the other. This is what I came out of. This is what I know, and that's what I'm going to make the comparisons with.
And there's even a better reason, and that is there is not one other religion on the face of the earth who claims to do what they do in the name of Jesus, the Savior of the world, the world
exactly.
Redeemer. They would claim that Jesus, they'd agree with the Bible that he came to save the world. They'll give you all manner of different kind of BS about.
Yes, ands, buts, and maybes.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, Hindus aren't doing it in the name of Jesus, as you've said. Buddhists exactly. aren't doing it in the name of Jesus. The only people who are doing it in the name of Jesus are Christians. And I think that plays into this a little bit.
Really does. That's the one, the reason that we, that I myself, I'm not going to include anybody else in on this because we get in, I get into so much trouble for it. But there is a reason for the madness, folks, and that is the integrity of the gospel.
And by integrity, what you're saying is?
There are no ifs, ands, buts, and maybes with the gospel. And when you have a religion who has taken all of the work of the cross and the work of Christ, then they take that name and they completely eliminate the gospel of grace and the gospel of peace declared to the whole world. And I'm telling you, I just don't get it. I mean, it's like, well, I want to share grace with just my little group. I want to share grace with the people. We need to do this and we got to do that. And that makes us exclusive. How in the world do you come up with the act of God that produced this stuff? Why? Why? One of the questions that I would return to people when I first started sharing the redemption of the world was this. If God wanted to redeem everybody at the cross, could he have done it?
Yes.
Without exception and with more hesitation than what you gave.
Well, see, I'm afraid you might be trapping me. So I got to be real careful here.
There's always a trap somewhere, isn't there?
Well, you have an Indian heritage, and I just... oh, did I say Indian? I'm sorry. That's it.
Yes, you did. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I got to call some of the brothers.
Oh,
but anyway, in asking people, you know, could he have redeemed the world, they... even with great hesitation and humming and hawing and, well, that's not the point and blah, blah, blah. No, please just answer me one question. You've been asking me questions for 3.5 hours now. Please answer me one question.
What, they'll fishtail, they'll prevaricate, they'll come up with red herrings, they'll switch the subject. And in the end, almost always, what I've found is people do is they say, "Ah, you just don't get it. I'm not going to argue with you. The Bible tells me not to debate with fools and blah, blah, blah." They'll use any. But answer a question, that could be just a mite too hard.
It really is. And the answer, of course, to that is if God wanted to, he could have redeemed the whole world at the cross. Could he have made a plan like that? Oh, yes, he could have. Paris, they actually think they're keeping some of the gospel by telling people you got to believe. Stop the presses. There is no gospel in you got to believe. There is none. God has redeemed this world through the power of the cross. He has canceled out all wrath, judgment. Judgment day has been canceled out. The termination of this planet again, as he did with the flood, has been canceled because of the work of the cross. People just say, well, I just don't believe a loving God could ever cast somebody into hell. Please don't ever say that, because no matter how loving he is, he can do anything he wanted.
That's what makes God God. It's not that he's holy, not that he's righteous, not that he's good, not that he's yours, not that he's Christian, not that he's Jewish. It's that he's got all the dang power. I mean, if the devil had all the power, he'd be God.
I just... So these are the people on the better side of the team, if you will, in this thing. And then they come up with this totally vapid argument. Well, I just don't believe that a God of love would ever do that. Well, so you're saying you know everything about God. You see, the power of the gospel that we're sharing, Barris, we don't even try to tell people about what God does and does not do. We tell people what God did, and as a result of that, not what opinion we should have of him, but the opinion he has of us.
We're not gonna take it. gonna take it anymore. I'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. This is Jackie Barnard. I want to share with you my experience of becoming a Christian and trying to live the Christian life. And then I will share with you just for a moment what it means to me that I have left that life having been arrested by the gospel. I remember that night. It was an August night in Camp Mount Bethel Free Will Baptist Church Camp near Ashburn, Georgia. Steamy, hot August night many years ago, when I forced myself to accept Jesus into my heart. I was only 5 years old. I thought Jesus was already in my heart. But I allowed them to convince me that Jesus was standing at my heart's door knocking. And I actually had a vision that night, just a glimpse of Jesus, a physical Jesus standing beside me instead of being inside me. And that night I forced myself to accept Jesus into my heart as a five-year-old boy. It seems so long ago, and I wrote some verses, some, if you want to call it poetry, that'll be okay, but it seems so long ago that guilt enslaved me so. Guilt told me what to think of me and when and what to do. It said to bow my head in shame, confess my evil ways, conviction of unworthiness swallowed all my days. So I obeyed and blamed myself for always falling short. God's grace must surely help me make yet another start. And to the mourner's bench I flew and confessed what God already knew, that I would only fail again before I returned to the pew. My friends said I should read of saints like Augustine and Spurgeon, but when I read such men, I'd faint. Their stories added to my burden. How could I, so weak and frail, offer up such pleas that shook the gates of hell and brought kingdoms to their knees? It's been this way since I was five, since Christian thoughts came alive. My friends and family said, you'll see, believe in Jesus and be set free. Now that's where the poem and the story of my Christianity comes to a close. You can tell by the thoughts that I just shared with you how deeply in bondage I was, how serious I was, how much I wanted to show the world how much I really loved Jesus, because I did with all my heart. And this went on for many, many years. I struggled with myself. I became, as good Christians have to do, I became the ultimate fake. When I was in high school, people sought me out to counsel them about their sins and help them get right with Jesus. And you know, I would tell them all the stuff that, you know, all these things and that what they had to do, believe enough, behave better. And all the time knowing that I was a hypocrite. So anyway, that's the end of that. And it's depressing to think of that. What I've come to learn in the gospel, though, is that my identity has always been in Christ, that he believed and behaved for me, that he was who I wanted to be. He already was that for me. He'd already been there and done that, as they say, and I just was so busy defending the lies of Christianity that I couldn't see the truth of the gospel. So I appreciate Mike, Darius, Jeff, Depp Washburn, Jill Howell, Richard Mull, Billy Thompson, of course. Glenn Klein has done a tremendous amount. Gosh, Glenn has helped me so much. He has a way with putting things into context and into words that are so understandable. Anyway, I just wanted to share that, and I hope it'll be beneficial to somebody along the way.
The gospel says the war is done. Guilt and judgment, there's none. The Father's covenant with the Son made God and human family one. God and man enjoy the gain. That stealthy gospel rides again. Before the light had dawned in me, difference was all that I could see. Oh, if you don't pray the sinner's prayer, you're on your way to hell's despair. But now, I know we're all the same. The stealthy gospel rides again. New wine in old skins cannot stay. New skin's a must, or the old will burst, and old and new will fall away. New wine's a fountain from within. That stealthy gospel rides again. How well I see in life's rear view, my criticism came undone. My mind began to open up. Judging had a softer touch. I am so free, so calm, so sane. That stealthy gospel, it rides again.
Chris Harrison wrote this question on our private group, Gospel Revolution private group this week. Mike, he said, "In how do you read this verse?" And then he's quoting Romans 9:22-24. "In the same way, even though God has the right to show his anger and his power, he is very patient with those on whom his anger falls, who are destined for destruction. He does this to make the riches of his glory shine even brighter on those to whom he shows mercy, who were prepared in advance for glory. And we were among those whom he selected, both from the Jews and from the Gentiles." Interesting question.
Yes, and again, context. These are a list of comparisons that go throughout this chapter, all the way through. Oh, goodness, it starts actually in verse 13 of these comparisons. There's a great deal that's established in, of course, the chapters before and the earlier part of chapter 9. But for the sake of time, let's back up just one more verse from where the question started at verse 21. "Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump?" So the first thing you got to realize is that no matter what you're looking at, this is all out of the same lump. This is all the same thing. "The potter hath the power to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor." When you read this in its context, this is not current. And again, oh, Ferris, this really is perfect because, again, this has nothing to do with what's happening today. The dividing line for understanding the gospel isn't whether or not I got on the plane that was headed for destruction or not. The dividing line for understanding the cross or understanding the gospel is the cross. So when you see that he had one group that was from one lump, he made vessels of honor and another vessels of dishonor. Those two groups are before and after the cross. This is not something of a selection that's going on at this point. So, and then what if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much suffering the vessels of wrath fitted for destruction? Well, that's very clear that these are the people under the first covenant. Well, and in fact, the Jewish people, if you will.
Well, Paul says elsewhere, where there is a law,
that's where the wrath is.
Yeah.
Yes, that's where the wrath is. And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy. Now, this dividing line is not those that God is choosing and to have mercy on and those he's choosing to have wrath on today. This is the difference between the two covenants, because that's what this entire book of Romans is about, is the two covenants. And that he might make known the riches of his mercy, which he hath afore prepared unto glory, even us, whom he hath called, not just of the Jews, but of also of the Gentiles. And then, of course, this goes on, and I encourage, this is, goodness, if we could, we would just go down through here and teach all of this. But let me go down just a little bit from there into verse 27. Isaiah also crieth concerning Israel, "Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved." Then verse 28, "For he will finish the work." So we've been trying to figure out who's the remnant, who's the remnant, who's the remnant. We want to know who's the remnant, who's the tithe. I wish we would ask who about everything. One key that rests with me is everything that was a what in the old covenant became a who in the new covenant. The remnant was a what? This became a who. It became an individual. And for he would finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth. This is another verse taken out of context and saying, oh man, the end times is a coming and God's going to do a quick work on the earth. Oh man, you're not going to know what's happening and you're just going to think everything's peach keen and bam, God is going to judge the whole earth and Jesus is coming back.
Yeah, but Mike, 2,000 years, it's only been a couple of thousand years, and compared with 6,000 years of human history, according to the Bible, 2,000 years is still a pretty short time.
I think 3 days is even better.
I'll see your verse and raise you a chapter. Okay.
Exactly. And I'll take your time and decrease it by 2,000 years. For he will finish the work. That's what in the world did Jesus say on the cross?
It might be, maybe, if and but.
I
nearly pulled that off, I think he said.
Yeah. Thank God it is finished. And in verse 29, Isaiah saith before, except the Lord of the Sabbath had left us a seed, we would have been as Sodom, we had been made like unto Gomorrah. The seed is what prevents the planet from being dealt with the same, regardless of what you think that Sodom and Gomorrah was dealt with in the way that it was by God. The prophecy here that Paul is quoting is that the seed is what keeps us from being in ever falling. We'd have been like these people that were under wrath. We'd have been just like them. There is nothing, please understand, there is nothing that would exempt anyone on this planet from the wrath of God except the seed. And the seed had within it everything that a seed contains. It's not added later. That's just, I didn't come up with these comparisons and these analogies. These are the things that were established in the scriptures and Paul is teaching on here. What shall we say then? That the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith? But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, hath not attained to the law of righteousness? Wherefore, because they sought it not by faith, but as were by the works of the law, for they stumbled at the stumbling stone. And that stumbling stone was Christ, that stumbling stone of faith. It was the stumbling because it is the faith of Christ that they stumbled over and continued to try to have their own instead of rely on the work and the faith of God.
So Paul says in verse 15 of this same chapter, chapter 9 of Romans, he said to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. Sounds like God is a Calvinist. So then is Paul saying, so we surmise from this previous statement. We surmise from this previous statement that God will have mercy on whomever he will have mercy, that it's not of him who willeth, nor him that runneth, but of God that shows mercy. Mm-hmm. So now willing is believing. What you do with your will is you believe stuff. You decide stuff. You enforce stuff that, you know, like New Year's resolutions. But willeth has to do with believing. So, And Paul's saying it's not of him that believes, nor of him that runs a work. It's not of believing and it's not through works, but of God who shows mercy. And both of those, willing and running, are both righteousness that is apart from God. It's self-righteousness.
It indeed is. And here Paul is he's establishing the template from which he is wanting us to think in these terms. Now, so he takes us back to the basics. All right, so when God has mercy and when God has judgment, he does it because he wants to. This has nothing to do with man at all. Now that we understand that mercy and judgment both come at the sole discretion of God, it has nothing to do. Mercy nor judgment comes at the discretion of man. Mercy or judgment come at the will of man. Mercy and judgment comes not by him that runneth, nor him that willeth. So now that we understand that when God does show mercy, when God does show his wrath, man's will has nothing to do with it. So now that we've established this Calvinistic doctrine, let's go on and understand that this is simply the template for understanding that the dividing line is not in the middle of people's lives today. The dividing line was at the cross.
See, it's like the very hide of human pride to say that the two groups it's talking about are the good people and bad people. It's us and them. It's you and us. If that's not self-righteousness, what is?
Well, and if that is the way it is, then we are of all men all lost. There is no one. You see, if this will and running, who can run fast enough? Who can will enough?
Who can do it better than God? Who can run faster than God?
Or run with him, or run as fast as he does. I mean, that's not get ahead of God. You know, they always say, don't get ahead of God now. Yeah. Well, let's not get ahead of him. Let's just keep up with him. But how can your will keep up with God? And how can your running keep up with God? This is the power of the gospel itself, my friends. This is the essence of this great mystery that was hidden from generations, but now is made manifest unto us. He has done it. He's shown it through the marriage covenant. He's shown it through the seed. He's shown it through so many things that we can't even have the time to begin to go into here. I'm going to go into it in more detail in Calgary.
Plug for my meetings. Yeah,
shameless
right. Teaser. Hey, was it Peter who said, and these things that we have today, all of those old prophets, it wasn't shown to them what it was. I think it was Pete. And the picture I get in my brain is Isaiah, and he's taking a swig of goat's foam and speaking to his scribe, who's writing furiously, and he says something like, and in those days, people who never sought me will find me, and turns to his scribe, and he says, what on earth does that mean? The scribe says, I haven't any idea. And he said, well, just keep writing. And he says, on him will be all of his stripes. He'll take the chastisement for my peace. And he looks at the scribe again, and he says, what on earth is this about? And the scribe says, you're the prophet, you tell me.
Oh, man. Barris, I tell you, this is a great and marvelous gospel. And we stand in a position that is probably still fairly unique. I am hoping it is no longer unique. You know, when we hear of people opening up and beginning to understand, I am so grateful for Francois's Mirror Bible. That translation is so profound, and it just simply says it right there. But even with that translation, as good as it is, if people do not come to the conclusion that the comparisons are before and after the cross, not your life, then even the Mirror Bible will be misconstrued into self-righteousness and a superficial grace for people. So whether you are in whatever translation, and as I've said, goodness gracious, I've got both of the Mirror Bibles here with me and make reference to them often. I can't wait to take it to Canada and be able to do some teaching and able to quote out of it, because the translation is amazing.
You'll be having a tape and book stand again. I can see the old days coming back.
Oh, I know. Absolutely.
By the way, can I? Maybe this is a good time for me to tell our Canadian friends. I was scheduled to visit Canada with you, Mike.
Yes, you were.
But circumstances being what they are, I'm not able to go. So I spoke with Vic, and he and I agreed that not much time is going to pass before we try for this again.
That's exactly right.
But I'm so sorry, family up in Canada. You have no idea how much I'm looking forward to meeting you. And I just thought I'd throw that in there, Michael, because you reminded me.
Yes, and thank you so much. And we definitely were looking forward to having you there.
I can understand that. You're only human.
But the need for you is greater right there in Nashville, Tennessee right now. And as Laura continues to progress and the new norms, whatever those are for you guys, are established, I'm sure you'll be able to get away for a while. I'm sure Laura will be glad for you to go eventually.
Oh, you ain't whistling Dixie. You know that's true.
Listen in your office, in your car, or even your neighborhood bar. You can listen with your whole family. Do a
gospel revolution.
And so it is that we must leave you, folks. We love you one and all, and we especially thank all who, with your financial support, keep this message of grace and peace going out every week. If you would like to join them in increasing our coverage of this gospel, call our office at area code 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey. If you would like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone me on area code 234-564-0971. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and we are always up for a Facebook chat at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, All the Gospel All the Time is being broadcast 24/7 at myradiostream.com/gospelrevolution. And so, it is good night from myself, Barris Bartlett, from the Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee.
And it's good night from Michael Williams, right here in beautiful Houston, Texas. Thank you, guys. We love you beyond words and appreciate that you tune in. Let us know what you're thinking about what we're saying, because this is a two-way street. We need to hear from you. The thing that made this show really, really good is responding to your comments and your questions. Thank you so much. We love you.
So thank you to Maya Angelou for a lifetime of graciousness, to Chris Harrison and Danny Rogers for great questions. And to all of you who are listening, thank you very much. Remember to join us again next week, same time, same channel, where we're going to do the same thing all over again.
Always better.
Are we done, or is there more you want?
I'm done.
Okay.
That was exciting. I loved doing that.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Bears. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Gospel Revolution.